is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I'm Jean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro The Social Network and pro John Lithgow podcast, where we stick to the list for better or worse. This week we have changed tack, I would say pretty severely, from what is regarded as one of the best films, possibly the best film of the 2010s, to one that is not. We of course have talked about one of Wes Craven's final forays into the realm of horror, My Soul to Take.
One of his final forays, full stop. This was his second last film before he passed away.
Makes you really glad that Scream 4 is there.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get into that, we'll talk about what we've seen within the week. Lawson, why don't you start us off?
Sure thing. I've only got three movies to talk about this week. The first of them is Altitude. It is a horror thriller directed by Carl Andrews, and it is about five unlikable dimwits who are flying to a Coldplay concert in a twin-engine plane that one of them is piloting, and mechanical issues cause them to fly into a storm where they run afoul of a giant tentacled monster.
Oh, cool.
This is a really cool premise. It's constrained by its budget, though. The monster is the pitch, but it's practically a footnote in the final version. You see so very little of it. It's mostly about tension in the group, and that is let down by the fact that there is often some extremely bad writing and characterization. Every character is basically a jerk or a creep, but it does mine a lot of drama out of the general premise, and it doesn't overstay its welcome. This is a movie that is done by the 90-minute mark. The actors aren't great, but I'm quicker to blame the script than I am them, and that, you know, they do manage a handful of really strong set pieces along the way. They do manage to make parts of it work. Only when they come to actually explain what's going on with this tentacled monster in the sky, it's bonkers, and not in a good way. It really actually undercuts all of the tension because the explanation is simply ridiculous and unjustifiable. And the ending that it triggers doesn't really make sense. It's spent so much time trying to be clever, it hasn't actually constructed a storyline that gets it to that point. Visually, though, I have no complaints. This is actually a fairly impressive-looking film, considering the budget. It's very dark and gloomy, and they make a lot out of the fact. I mean, it really is a single-location movie in a lot of ways. It's these people in this small twin-engine plane, but they use whatever budget they saved on locations to get some good, like, lighting and atmosphere and stuff going on. So I'll sign off on that. That's a pretty good element. It's available for streaming in Australia on 7 Plus, if anyone's interested.
Doesn't bode well, does it?
Well, 7 Plus, I don't know. I don't know how you get on 7 Plus, whether it just means that you've screened on 7, the network 7, recently. But, yeah, it's been popping up a lot more recently, I've noticed. I next saw Troll Hunter. It is a Norwegian found footage monster movie directed by André Øvredal. And it's about a trio of amateur documentarians, Thomas, played by Glenn Erland Tosterud, Joanna, played by Joanna Mork, and Carl, played by Thomas Alf Larsen. They're tracking a suspected bear poacher named Hans, played by Otto Jespersen, and they're following him around on the sly. And one day when they follow him into the woods, they find that he is actually not hunting bears, but he's in fact hunting trolls for the government, and he lets them tag along. This is a lot better in concept than it is in execution, in my opinion. I know people really love this movie. I don't. I don't really see the love either. I mean, it's incredibly ambitious and it's incredibly unique, but that isn't enough to carry it for me when there's so little substance to it. There's very little story, very little character. The pace, I think, is far too slow. It's a lot of plodding around the forest, only occasionally interrupted by a CGI troll. But those CGI trolls are cool. They have a very sort of fantastical, almost fairy tale design. They're kind of Guillermo del Toro-esque in that sense. And there are some decent set pieces with them, but it just chains them together without too much plot to connect them. There is an undercurrent of satire, though. There's all of this sort of governmental bureaucracy, the idea that there's this government department that is in charge of keeping these trolls from being discovered and found out. Even though it never really explains why the government would be concerned about people finding out. I mean, it's just like, why are they keeping it a secret? That's never really addressed. But there's also this stuff like, you know, the whole, all of that whole rhyming idea, blood of a Christian man, all of that stuff in the lore, the folklore of trolls, is like real and handled in a fairly deadpan way. Like one of them is secretly believes in God, and so the troll can smell him, like stuff like that. But all of the dry wit and the sort of cultural satire, I would say, is probably better if you're Norwegian. But as someone who isn't, a lot of it was lost on me, I think. But the effects work really holds up. The trolls look good, and they make good use of the extraordinary landscapes that they're filming in. Like, it looks gorgeous, these environments. But ultimately, as a story, it just doesn't really go anywhere. Lastly, this week I saw Due Date. It is a comedy directed by Todd Phillips, and it's about this high-strung architect with anger management problems named Peter, played by Robert Downey Jr. He is basically has an encounter with an inept man-child named Ethan, played by Zach Galifianakis, and they have this sort of argument, this snafu that gets them thrown off the plane that they're both on just before it takes off, and he needs to get, well, Peter needs to get back to Hollywood, because his wife is about to give birth, and Ethan is heading that way as well, and so they sort of team up to drive it, even though Peter can't stand Ethan, and of course they get into a bunch of misadventures along the way. This is no classic, but I did find it amusing enough. It's a lot darker than I expected. Robert Downey Jr. punches a child in this, like, intentionally.
Oh, cool.
And I love that your reaction to someone punching a child is, oh, cool.
No, I mean, it doesn't happen often in movies. So this, Afterlife, where Justin Long punches a kid, I mean, it's notable.
Nicole Kidman in The Invasion, where she, like,
yeah,
smacks that kid that's possessed,
yes,
by the alien.
I gift that for you.
Yes, you did. Thank you. Robert Downey Jr. also spits in a dog's face.
That's
but,
less cool.
It's more the punctuation of this extremely kind of, like, vicious sequence that it's the surprise of it that makes it work. But it is better the darker and the crazier it gets. It increases in quality as it goes on. And they do find this sort of thread of dramatic tension that is effective. It gives the characters dimension. It plays on the lead's strengths extremely well. Galifianakis is sort of just more of the same that you've seen in every other Zach Galifianakis performance. But Downey is playing something a little bit harsher than you normally see from him. Especially in this new era of Robert Downey Jr. that we're in now. And there's a viciousness to the character that I think is quite amusing, but also, like, dramatically effective. The humor is rarely laugh out loud, though it is generally amusing. It really is mostly the cast and chemistry between them that keeps it going. But something that really impressed me was the way that Todd Phillips shoots it. He shoots it for tone. He shoots it for atmosphere and for generating, you know, reflections of character. It's not just the normal sort of shot, reverse shot, brightly lit things. You know, most comedies, they don't pay much attention to the visual look of things. It just is, you know, when you see, you know, random Adam Sandler comedy or, you know, random Melissa McCarthy, even like Judd Apatow or someone like that, they don't pay attention to the visual panache of the thing so much.
Well, really, it's, they work a lot with the fundamentals.
Yeah.
Which are important. Obviously, they're the bedrock of cinematic language, but they're not doing anything flashy.
Yeah. But Phillips mines some strong moments out of all that. And there's a great licensed soundtrack as well. It's available for streaming in Australia on Foxtel now, if anyone's interested. But that's me done for the week. Do you guys have anything to talk about?
No.
In that case, let's move on to pith takes.
I do just want to say, we don't have anything to talk about because we're kind of in the middle of a lot of series at the moment.
I do love that, like, you're so desperate to assure everyone that it's not because you aren't watching TV and movies. It's not, but please don't think that it's because we took a week off from watching a movie every night or whatever.
I know, we have been doing stuff. It's just sometimes you don't watch anything new. I know this is not a Lawson problem.
It is sometimes. Like, I'm the person that's in charge of picking the movies for the next week. So when I'm got a week where, you know, events overtake me and I've only seen like two or three movies, yeah, it becomes a problem. Like, I can't slow down. Anyways, I do have, well, Harley and I both have piss takes this week. I've got two, though. I'm going to start off with Ishmael. It is a play that I went and saw this week. It's a science fiction drama written by David Morton. It's loosely based on the novel Moby Dick by Herman Melville, only it is set in the year 3022, when most of Earth is gone, basically. And the whole place is covered by smog, this heavy cloud cover. The poor people live below the cloud cover, and the rich people live on the highest peaks, just barely peeking out above the top. And a corporation runs the planet now, basically. And we follow Ishmael, played by Ellen Bailey. She is from below the clouds, and she cons her way up, and she's fleeing something. We don't quite know what she's running away from, but we will find out as the story goes on. And she cons her way onto a mining ship named the Pequod, a mining spaceship, I should say, captained by the irascible Ahab, played by Barbara Lowing. And there is also on the ship a mysterious droid named Queequeg, played by Carl Richmond. But together, the three of them go out into space to sort of mine asteroids. But along the way, it becomes clear that Ahab is on the ma is on a mad quest to find the space monster that killed her brother, and will basically doesn't really care that she's putting them in danger to pursue this.
Hey, she has a goal. Everyone needs a quest.
So this is a play done by a company in Brisbane called the Dead Puppet Society,
Ah,
who
yes.
do these hugely ambitious plays where they really do a lot of groundbreaking, like visual effects work, puppetry work, lighting stuff. Like it really is a visual sort of experience, in a sense. They really push what it means to be on the on stage in the space and what you can do in that. And like you might have been wondering, listening to that, that plot description, how could you possibly achieve this with people standing on a stage? Well, they use a lot of miniatures, and it's part of the show. It's part of the show that you can see them manipulating it as you do it. So they've got all of the actors in front of this projection screen, right? And the actors are all acting it out in front of the projection screen, but behind them, you see whatever the environment is that they're supposed to be in, whether that's space or whether that's the city. But on either side of the main stage, they have these little green screen booths that have miniatures in them. And live cameras with the feeds going to that backdrop. So you can actually see on either side of the stage them manipulating the spaceships or them, turning the miniatures to make sort of a dynamic revolving shot for the backdrop behind the actors as they're doing it. And
That's fucking brilliant.
yeah, it's really cool. And they do at other points some like sort of puppetry stuff when they actually go out and it's like this big sort of like swooping around an asteroid field or something, they will actually bring out these rigs where they will actually have like a model spaceship on and it'll sort of zoom around in front of this backdrop as the actors are piloting them and doing their lines and everything.
I had never considered
Yeah, it's
that trick with the green screens. My God, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's a big aesthetic, and it mostly pulls it off. It mostly manages to get that sort of science fiction massive scope onto a very small stage, the theatre stage, comparatively. And it uses the goodwill of theatre that you have. As an audience member, you have a goodwill for the people that are doing this performance in front of you. And this
And
suspension of disbelief, it comes from everything. When you're watching Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you just buy the fact that there is no ceiling and one of the walls is missing. Like you just suspend your disbelief that everything you're seeing there, like it's just everything. Like Hamilton takes place in on a fairly bare bones stage without much in the way of set dressing, that and it doesn't change. The set dressing doesn't change from scene to scene. But you have the goodwill, you have the suspension of disbelief to just sort of buy the fact that no, they are actually in a field or they are in Congress or whatever. And this uses that in that way, in a very effective way.
Well, and also considering that they have truly so many moving parts, as you've described, that you gotta cut people some slack.
Oh yeah, like I was they were that these bits where they're manipulating the puppets or they're swinging they've got these like little craft that go out from the main craft, and so each of the characters is piloting one of them. So each of them are in this rig with these like chairs with wheels on them that they could sort of push themselves around on the stage, but with these massive sort of almost crane-like puppets with this big spaceship or this big sort of shuttle on the end that each one of them was piloting. So they're all going around, swinging it around. I just kept waiting for one of them to belt another one in the head with it or something, because it is very much about the timing. And that is something else. I mean, it's experimental in its structure as well as in its execution. There are a lot of uses of montage in a way that I very have rarely seen in plays. There's a lot of use of actual licensed music, a lot of like songs, but not in a musical sense, in a sense that like you're watching a movie or a TV show and there's just a song playing over a scene or over a montage. All of these songs are licensed from a singer named Beck Sandridge, and it's really, really intricate timing because they sort of punctuate these dramatic moments with parts of the song. And so the actors have got to be like right on it. They've got to be like right on hitting the this line at this part. They can't have slowed down, they can't have sped up, because otherwise the moment is ruined from the dramatic use of the licensed music. It's a very, very interesting, very sort of daring thing. And the story is a compelling character piece. It is three people on a spaceship mostly, and they're all running. They're all confronted by the thing they're running from in the end. I mean, that is the basic drama of it. Here's the rub, though. This all is great, but the script frequently falls flat. Sometimes it works, a lot of times it goes splat. Like, they've gotten so invested in making this sort of visually splendid, aesthetically terrific story that they've actually, the dialogue is frequently quite bad. And there were people laughing at some of the lines in the theater, which is not what you want. And it really, it could have used another draft. But Bailey and Richmond are fine. They are a little flat at times. Again, this is one of those situations where I blame the script more than I blame them. But Barbara Lowing as Ahab is pretty spectacular. Like, she is a scene stealer. She is really good. Yeah, it uses theater as a concept really well, but it really, I just think if you did another draft, if you shave some of the clunky edges off those lines, you could have something really special in narrative as well as in
Yeah.
presentation. But
Need a little more time in the kiln.
yeah, definitely though, if either of you have the opportunity to go and see it, and I do think, I mean, Dead Puppet Society, they do stuff like I saw this at QPAC, but they do more sort of regional things sometimes. They do smaller things. So, and they've only got they do their own plays, but they will go back and redo their own plays while they're developing a new one. So I suspect at some point you guys will have the opportunity to see it again somewhere. And I would recommend that you do, because I think that you guys would get a lot out of the theatre work.
They're some of the most, they're probably among the most impressive, most inventive troops out there.
Yeah.
Like, because they're pushing the medium. You know, like going back to As You Like It, which we saw a couple weeks back, that was brilliant. But a lot of what they were doing was very, very established techniques. The Brechtian stuff, the more standard acting stuff, stuff you do in a black box theater, all of that was very established techniques, done perfectly. But the medium does need those innovators, does need those people pushing the boundaries, which Dead Puppet Society oftentimes do. So it's great to hear that they've been experimenting with more tech.
My second piss take is a book, a non-fiction book that I've been plucking my way through on and off for 6 months now. It is The Devil in the White City: Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. It is written by Eric Larson, and it recounts the events of the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago and the simultaneous killing spree of the serial killer H.H. Holmes, who
Jesus.
was running a murder hotel. Like real Scooby-Doo shit with like secret death traps and stuff. And that he was killing basically young women who came to stay in his hotel. This is a really compelling view of what was a changing time, not only in America, but in the world. And it's very interesting in the sense that the World's Columbian Exposition was sort of, it represents that in a big way. It represents the world coming into this one little spot in this park in Chicago, and all of the technological development, all of the cultural development, it's all there at once. And it's told through the split stories, Holmes and then Daniel Burnham, who is the architect who designed the fair, like ran it. I came here for the murder hotel. It's why I read this book. But
Course.
the exposition is the exhibition was what really got me. It's this really, really interesting story of this magnificent showing of human ingenuity. There was a lot of like obstacles, a lot of twists, a lot of drama. It's a thrilling story in and of itself, the story of how this fair came to be, how it was pulled off, because everything that could go wrong did go wrong. I mean, they had like 18 months to make the whole thing, and like you're making a small city. Like when you think of a fair, you're not thinking of what this was. Like this was like truly a small city, like made out of bricks and mortar and cement and designed like, Roman architecture and all sorts of things. Like I will find a picture of it for you, because that's the thing, the World's Fair stuff, like they are huge and they still do them today. In fact, QPAC was built for the World's Fair in the 80s that was in Brisbane. But like
World Expo.
this is one of the only surviving photos of the city they built.
I've definitely heard of this.
They made this in 18 months.
Okay, this might be really strange for me to say, but I'm drawing a lot of connections with how they're mirroring the World's Fair and H.H. Holmes to what was done in the Gotham by Gaslight animated movie.
Okay. Yes, you're right. I mean, this has become this sort of like touchstone of sort of Americana. I mean,
But
it's
you see
twisting
what I'm
Americana.
getting
I
at.
do, yeah. It's like this. It is a fairly incredible story, not only for the sort of parallel, ideas there, but also because what Holmes was doing was murder on a frankly like theatrical scale. Like the scoop, I said Scooby-Doo, it really was this Scooby-Doo bullshit. Like it was, and he was prolific. He killed a lot of people. And
By a lot of people, he's considered the first modern serial killer.
well, he came after Jack the Ripper, but
Well, one, like, he was the first American
yeah.
modern serial killer, which is a big deal because America was that America changed things in that regard. Like, I love how this book, the way you describe it, it's about modernity.
Yeah, it is about with between Burnham and Holmes, it is about these two men of considerable skill. Like that's the thing. Holmes, that story of his is fascinatingly gruesome because he is a brilliant, brilliant man. He's an evil genius because he has all of this charisma, he has all of this business acumen, he has an acute understanding of people and how to manipulate them and how to get what he wants from them.
And the construction of the murder hotel, rooms that don't exist, fake walls, hallways that don't go anywhere.
Like a straight up a vault that he used to pump gas into to kill people that he locked inside, or a massive furnace in the basement that he used to dispose of bodies. Like,
Murder on an industrial scale.
yeah. And it's you're matching this with the story of Burnham, who is a much more upstanding citizen, but in the same way, this guy who wanted to push the boundaries, wanted to like take this, grab modernity by the throat and be like, yes, here is what I can do with it. Here is how I can make my name. Here is how I can be the best at what I do. And you're sort of drawing these this sort of parallel storyline between these two men who never meet, as they take advantage of industry at this sort of turn of the century, the beginning of the turn of the century, taking what the world is becoming, and each with one on the one hand, collaborating with it and boosting it, and on the other hand, corrupting it. It's this creator and destroyer in this one spot at this really specific moment. That's a really interesting story that's drawn. The Holmes story is much less detailed, the historical record is, so you get a lot of supposition, but well-sourced supposition. I mean, you, and well admitted to supposition. Like the author is very clear when he's drawing parallels, when he's not parallels, when he's drawing conclusions that aren't necessarily entirely concretely backed by historical fact, because he has to fill in gaps.
Yeah, for sure. Like, the historical record on Holmes is a lot more sparse.
Yes. He was officially convicted of killing one person. It's fairly concrete that he killed, I think, about a dozen. But there is much circumstantial evidence that his victims probably closer in the hundreds than that.
Because, at the time, if a vagrant or undocumented person goes missing,
And it's that whole thing of Mr. March from the hotel season of American Horror Story was based off H.H. Holmes.
Well, yeah, it's an incredibly...
Was based off of him.
Yeah, it's an incredibly... Hostel. I mean, it's an incredibly influential story that has... Again, it's kind of like a... It's bizarre, you know? That's the thing that gets it more than anything else. It's not Ted Bundy or someone like going around killing people, you know, picking them up in a van and then killing
they
people in a basement
him.
Or something. No, he like built, again, this Scooby-Doo hotel that he was like running around doing all this stuff. And like some of the stuff that he did also was just kind of insane. Like, he would keep changing his identity to take out loans, and got like life insurance policies on his employees, and then he killed them. Like, it was this weird sort of, like, he turned it into this intricate like business, basically, where he made so much money doing these awful things. And that's the thing that I think that gets
it's
people
so American that
well,
he's
yeah,
turned
exactly.
murder
it,
into a franchise.
Is. Exactly. He's franchised murder. And that is a really interesting path to take in this story. And Larson writes with a real narrative zeal. He unfolds everything like a thriller, and has a flair for the dramatic. He knows when to withhold information and then when to reveal it so that it makes the most storytelling impact. One of the things I really liked about it, too, was that it becomes about a time and a place, as well as about these two men. There's a lot of flavor about Chicago and about the world events that were going on at this time, and they often add to the drama. Like I mentioned, a massive financial crisis occurred in the year that the fair happened. Multiple banks collapsed across the country, huge problems in Europe, and it really did put a boot on the throat of the fair. And like, is this going to succeed? At the same time, there's like a political assassination that becomes a huge like key point. And there are all of these little subplots threaded through that are really about, again, it comes to this point of like the world evolving into something new and connected and big, bigger than it was before, but at the same time, somehow smaller. And that's at the real crux of it. Beyond just this story of the fair and this murderer, that is what it's about. It's really, really captivating. And there was, I mean, Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio have been trying to make this into a, well, at first they tried a movie for years that didn't end up going anywhere. Now they're trying to make it into a mini series. Hulu ordered it to series a while ago. Keanu Reeves was attached to play Burnham, but dropped out, perhaps because he realized that, the 1800s is not a good time period for him. He dropped out.
Because he knows where the bastard sleeps.
He dropped out and Hulu rescinded its series order. So Scorsese and DiCaprio are now shopping it elsewhere. And
it's in the wind.
I really hope that it gets made eventually, because it could be so, so good.
And it's a good thing for both DiCaprio and Scorsese. It's something that fits their vibe to a fucking T.
Oh, very much, yeah. Anyways,
like, done in the style of Shutter Island? Absolutely.
Visual style, not storytelling structure.
Of course, but, you know.
Anyways, that's me done for the week.
So, I also have a pit take. It is a short story compilation called Full Throttle by Joe Hill. It's a short story compilation of several different stories. I'll just list them now. I listened to the audiobook. Throttle, which Joe wrote with his father Stephen King, read by Stephen Lang. Dark Carousel, read by Nate Caudry. Wolverton Station, read by Neil Gaiman. By the Silver Water of Lake Champlain, read by Kate Mulgrew. Fawn, read by Zachary Quinto. Late Returns, read by Will Wheaton. All I Care About Is You, read by Ashley Cummings. Thumbprint, read by Laisla de Oliveira. The Devil on the Staircase, read by George Guidall. In the Tall Grass, also co-written by Stephen King, read by Stephen Lang, and You Were Released, read by Joe Hill himself. I love short story compilations. I get a big kick out of them because they're very concise, they're very tight, and very focused. With a longer form novel, and Lawson, you'd be able to attest to this, a writer can kind of lose track of where they're going, add too much. That's a real Stephen King issue. Adds too many factors, so he has trouble resolving things by the end. Joe doesn't have that same problem in his long-form storytelling, but it's clearly not present in his short story fare. Some of my favorites here are Dark Carousel. Wolverton Station is particularly great, especially since it's read by Neil Gaiman. You don't get a lot of Gaiman narrating other people's work, so I found this quite interesting. By the Silver Water of Lake Champlain is something Jorn would recognize. This was adapted in Creepshow.
Mm.
Directed by family friend of the King's and longtime friend of Joe, Tom Savini. The Devil on the Staircase feels very Guillermo del Toro in design. It's got that fairy tale quality, that dark, disturbing fairy tale quality of Guillermo del Toro's work. In the Tall Grass is really good. Stephen Lang does really well. I do not recall much from the movie that came out on Netflix, but I do remember liking it. And in audiobook format, it's a lot more interesting because it's a lot more vague. You Were Released is really good too, because that one is the story of a plane in the air as almost every country on Earth fires their nuclear warheads at once.
Oh, that's cool.
And what happens to the people on the plane looking out the windows and seeing that? It's actually really fucking good. But the best story in this compilation is Late Returns, narrated by Will Wheaton. It is, the basic concept of the story is a bookmobile that can basically move through time in a sense. Like, it kind of slides through time, and some people on the verge of their death can appear as late returns. They can return books that they would have never gotten around to returning, and basically take out a book and read it as their last book. And even books from the modern day can be read by these people from 30, 40, 50 years in the past. I'm not doing the story justice by describing it. It is beautiful. It is moving. It is such a touching story about grief, loss, and the power of the ghost as a concept. Because the key factor in every ghost story is not just death, but time. It is how time and history comes back to us, and how we, in turn, change it by our recollection of it. It is a deeply moving story. I would love to see someone like Mike Flanagan adapt it for something like Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities, because it could be incredibly, incredibly moving.
Yeah, and Harley did show me Late Returns, and everything he's saying, I agree with. It's beautiful, sad, interesting in the way that it is talking about time and grief. And it's
and also the power of a really good book.
Yeah, it's just beautifully read by Will Wheaton as well.
Yeah. Will Wheaton's actually a really, really good audiobook narrator. I found, like, he did a bit in the third season of... Not third season, but the third audiobook for The Sandman. He was the narrator for the portion... He was, like, the primary narrator of the World's End segments. And he did the wraparounds for that. And he was fantastic there. So, in the audiobook space, he's, like, second to none. He's incredible. And he brings that sense of... He brings the sense of calm to Late Returns, which I find very, very necessary for the story. Joe Hill is quickly becoming one of my favorite short story writers, particularly in the stories he tells about ghosts. Because he does have that not unique viewpoint on the stories, but an incredibly unique voice. I'm currently also going through another audiobook of his short stories called 20th Century Ghosts, in which was also The Black Phone. So Joe Hill is quickly becoming one of my favorite authors. And he may at some point surpass his father for me. I don't know. We'll see where it goes.
I don't know. I think you've got to, like, look at the whole... I know Stephen King has... I mean, he's been around so long that there's a hit-and-miss aspect to Stephen King, but you got to see just how many hits there are in a level of, like...
I know, but, like, Stephen King is still one of the greatest and most prolific authors, not just horror writers, authors full stop, in the 20th century. Like, the, I had this conversation with people online, like, how Stephen King argues with right-wing people on Twitter all the time. At this point, his legacy is secure. Like, he can chill out, veg out, and troll people on Twitter as much as he likes. He still routinely gets his books onto the bestseller lists, and he basically gave Dean Koontz a career.
I'm just saying, like, listen to some of the hits here, and, like, none of these... None of what Joe Hill has done has reached the kind of, like, cultural capital of any of these. Carrie,
well, for sure. I just like how intimate Joe Hill's work is.
Like, Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, The Stand, Christine, Pet Sematary, It, The Dark Tower books, Misery, Needful Things, The Green Mile, The Shawshank Redemption. I mean...
Well, like... That's all fantastic, but what I'm saying is Joe Hill is, you can tell he's his father's son because they've got very similar way of speaking, similar authorial voice, and that really comes into stark relief with the stories that Joe wrote with his father. Throttle feels more like Stephen King, whereas In the Tall Grass definitely has Joe primarily written all over it. And Joe Hill has been getting a lot of adaptations of his own work as well.
Yeah.
Horns, the whole Lock and Key stuff, which in itself is fantastic. In the Tall Grass, Lake Champlain, in Creepshow. I think his career is one to really watch. Because Stephen King can't be doing this forever.
Well, no. How old is he now?
He has said that he's got a lot of books in the backlog. To be released after his passing.
Oh, so he's written them already?
Yeah. Like, Stephen King does not stop writing.
Yeah, he's 75, and according to Wikipedia, he's written 65 novels, 11 short story collections, 5 non-fiction books, 19 screenplays, and 16 of what is only categorized as other.
Like, Joe Hill is...
Over 200 short stories.
Yeah. Like, Joe Hill is a brilliant author in his own right, but in a world defined by legacy, Joe Hill is more than worthy to carry on.
Oh yeah, and credit to him. Credit to him for taking on the pen name so that he wasn't just so connected to his father, you know? Like, he everything he's got, he got himself because he didn't use the King name.
Yeah. Like, Lock and Key is a wild success in comic books. He had his own imprint at DC Comics called Hill House that he oversaw and wrote some of the titles in. I'm going to be buying that collection very shortly when I have the money. He's brilliant. That's just the fact of the matter. He's brilliant. And I just love the fact that even when Stephen King passes and his stories run dry... If they ever do, we still have the Prince of Horror living in the King's house, carrying on the job. And what a brilliant job he's doing so far. I listened to this on Audible, And I would highly recommend it. Like I said, I'm partway through 20th Century Ghosts, and I will be talking about that when I get to it. Because there's one particular story I do want to chat to you guys about, because I think you guys would love it. But yeah, so that's what we've seen within the week. Now we will play for you a short trailer to My Soul to Take.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. My name is Adam Hellerman, but everyone calls me Bug. I live in Riverton, Massachusetts, a small town notable for fishing, tourism, and the Riverton Ripper.
The Ripper was killed 16 years ago today, the very night that seven of us here were born. Some say we share more than just a birthday.
They found Jay Chan in the river this morning.
He's dead.
Pray for our souls, Bug. He's coming.
Hello? There's been no clue as to who this killer might be.
If he was evil enough, somebody you thought was dead come back alive?
Souls live on.
Do you think the Ripper came back to take his revenge?
What if his soul went into one of the seven kids who were born the night he died?
Bug?
Pray for our souls, Bug.
But which one?
Do you know who your father was? Take a look in the mirror, Bug.
You killed people, Bug. Not that I can remember.
You want to mess with someone? Mess with me.
That was the trailer for My Soul to Take. It is a supernatural slasher movie directed by Wes Craven, and it is set in the sleepy small town of Riverton. There isn't much to distinguish the place from every other Northern American town, save for the fact that 16 years ago, the population was terrorized by the Riverton Ripper. The Ripper was a serial killer who knocked off a bunch of people before the shocking revelation that he was actually family man Abel Plankov, played by Raul Esparza, who didn't even know he was the murderer. Abel had dissociative identity disorder and had seven personalities that he knew about and one very bloodthirsty one that he didn't. Shot by Detective Frank Patterson, played by Frank Grillo, he wandered off into the woods but was never found. Seven children were born the night the Ripper is presumed to have died. I'm not going to list them all because you only really have to pay attention to two. Adam Bug Hellerman, played by Max Thirico, and who behaves in an extremely bizarre manner at all times, and Alex Dunkelman, played by John Magaro, his peppy but put-upon best friend. The reason you don't have to worry about the other five is because they all start getting rapidly killed on the 16th anniversary of the Ripper's death. There are two long-standing urban legends surrounding the Riverton Ripper, either of which would explain this turn of events. The first is that he never really died, but instead retreated into the forest Voldemort style, biding his time and drinking unicorn blood or something. The second,
it Voorhees style.
The second is that he did die, and that his soul split into eighths, again very much like Voldemort, one for each normal personality and one for the Ripper. These soul fragments found purchase in the seven children born that night, and each grew up as the reincarnation of one of Abel Plankov's personalities. If that's true, though, who inherited the secret eighth personality? Who inherited the Ripper? So, before we get too deep into this, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on what we think of My Soul to Take? Why don't you start us off, Sean? Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
This had so much potential. The idea of this serial killer having been split between these seven kids is such an interesting idea. and all of the talk of sort of soul eaters, the California condor being this bird, this carrion bird that carries souls with it, is fascinating. All of this idea of, yeah, it's just poorly executed.
You ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
Wes, you created the most 2010s horror movie humanly possible in a bad way. Such a good concept. I will be repeating that ad nauseum throughout this deep dive, but the execution, man, what happened?
There is a thing that I've talked about on this podcast before, which is that no matter how bad a movie is, normally, when you're dealing with a studio-backed film made by professionals, you can expect some base level of competency. And you can expect to at least stay on the rails. Not be very spectacular, but just stay on the rails. And this does not. It goes flying off the rails within the first 3 minutes. And it never comes back on. Like, it is baffling in its absurdity. And that is one of the reasons I find it so fascinating.
Actually have a pitch to make this movie better.
All right, go.
So, our idea is, you keep it that Abel Plankoff...
The concept is fine.
Abel Plankoff was a serial killer with personalities, and he dies on that night, or disappears on that night. The souls latch themselves on to seven children born that night, including his kid that he presumed to be dead. So what we came up with the idea of is you slowly have the kids die. You don't kill three of them in the space of 6 fucking minutes, and you have it be that as the people die, Bug takes on aspects of their personalities, that he takes on the confidence but also the violence of Brandon. He takes on the creativity of
Jay,
that first kid who died. He takes on aspects of their personalities. Of course, this would mean that you'd have to write personalities for some of these characters. For sure, but follow. Just pause yourself for a second. Let me finish. So you actually have the group of the Riverton Seven come together and try to figure out who is murdering their number. Is it one of them? Is it Abel Plankoff, actually? Slowly but surely, Bug becomes more confident as the movie goes on. He starts speaking in their voices. He starts taking on their personality traits.
After they die, not before they do.
That's an important thing that they fucked up in the normal version. Slowly but surely, you realize that it is Bug's mate, Alex, who has taken on the Ripper. And you have it be that this Ripper personality is some kind of spirit that latched itself onto Abel and is collecting souls. You have it be that these personalities appeared during Abel's adulthood, and they are the personalities of the people that the Ripper killed, creating a tie between the speaking about the California condor as this carrion bird that collects souls, that this spirit, demon, whatever you want to call it, has been collecting souls, and when the body of Abel Plankoff died, they escaped into the first vessels that they could, which are these seven kids.
Abel escaping as well, latching himself onto Bug. And the Ripper has been waiting for 16 years before he was able to try again, reunite the family, so to speak.
Here's the thing. I think that the movie you're talking about, up until the bit about the Ripper soul being a demon or a being of some sort, everything up to that point is, I think, what Wes Craven was trying to do in this. I think
that's the issue.
Yeah, I think that what you're describing up until that final pivot is not actually a deviation of what the plan was here, because I think you can see that going on through the way that he sees visions of the first guy who dies in the mirror, the way that he does start talking in different voices at points. And I'm going to be referring through this podcast to information that I got that I think helps me understand it maybe a little bit more than you do, because they cut a lot of exposition from into deleted scenes.
Mm.
And I saw some scenes that make that a lot more clear. And in fact, that there was originally an alternate ending that was
The alternate ending.
Yes. They're walking along the... It makes it clear that all of the personalities are still with him. Like, he sees these visions of his friends still.
That Abel takes them on when they die.
Or Bug does.
Bug does, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
I would like to pitch the opening scene. One, okay. I have an issue with the opening sequence.
I don't. Too I think long. It's perfect. Leave it.
Okay, so here's my idea. You start it with a... It kind of already starts with, like, the shot of the moon. You pan it down, and you see the burning wreckage of the ambulance. Then as you pull back, you transition to 16 years later, panning over the carnage. Then you have the story of Abel Plankov's death and that of the Riverton Ripper. You have the exposition as we watch it happen. Mm. Like, you merge the two sequences together.
Well, what is clear from the deleted scenes is that they had absolutely no idea how to start this movie.
Yeah.
Because they had an alternate opening as well, which was going to be narration, like you're talking about, but it's Bug's sort of narration, which is pretty much literally, I bet you're wondering how I got here. But it's that scene in the bedroom at the end where he picks up the knife and you're sort of wondering what's going on. And then it cuts back to years earlier, 16 years earlier, for events that he was not present for. So I think, a really interesting movie in the sense that there are a few movies like this in Wes Craven's career. Obviously, the big one that we all know about is Cursed, which was, gutted by the Weinsteins, basically, gutted by studio demands and things like that. But the difference between that and this is that I can't see evidence that that was the case here. This just appears to be what Wes Craven made. And that is the odd thing here, because it's a big mess of ideas and a big mess in such a complete way that I think that what we're talking about, what you guys are talking about as potential fixes, are not really, in the sense that you can't just change one part of it, because it's like a thread on a jumper that you pull and eventually the whole thing unravels. The mess is also glued together.
Trying to do is take those core themes and concepts and trying to make something good out of
it. What you're talking, yes, exactly. The only way to really undo the mess of this movie is to restructure it entirely.
Yeah.
To give it new bones.
And that's
bones.
What I was doing.
Yeah. And that's a thing where, okay, I love the opening of this movie. I think it's hilarious.
Like, I love it too because it's funny. Not because it's good.
Yeah. But by the third time he sits up again and starts killing people, that was when I decided, okay, I need to talk to someone about this movie. but the interesting thing there is, again, they clearly had no idea how to start it, because we have so many different points of view in that opening scene. We don't really stick to anyone. We're sort of jumping around between, obviously Abel, but between his psychologist, between Frank Grillo, between the little girl who we will later find out is Bug's sister. It really is all over the place, and it's erratic. In some ways, it's fitting because it seems to have so many personalities.
I don't know if that's on purpose, though.
It's not on purpose. I'm saying it's ironic. It's not at all on purpose.
Yeah.
But, like, you can see a version of this, of this prologue that was entirely from Frank Grillo's perspective.
Yes.
Like, he gets a panicked phone call from, I can't believe it's Dr. Loomis in the middle of the night. and they're
Diet
going there.
Loomis. Yeah. He chokes and dies like a bitch.
Loomis
would not be caught unawares like that.
And he shouldn't be killed in the opening. He should have to come back. He should be chasing someone into the street, and that person should get cleaned up by a fucking car.
Well, that's the thing, is that the opening 5 minutes of this movie are basically an entire other movie abridged. Like,
yeah.
what you're seeing here is...
It's the ending of something else.
It's not even the ending. It's the whole thing. It's the whole 90-minute movie of a town under siege by a serial killer and the, you know, random family man who slowly discovers that he might have been doing it in his sleep or whatever. I mean, it's basically the plot of Shocker, which is another movie that Wes Craven made. And that's another thing that I'm sure we'll get more into, but he's pulling from everything in his filmography here. He's pulling from Elm Street, he's pulling from Scream, he's pulling from Shocker. But
he's pulling from Scream poorly. Yeah. I mean, he needed Williamson here. Fuck, he needed Williamson here.
But he's but as this opening scene is this whole other story condensed down, and then this, the movie part of this movie, is the sequel. And that's a really bizarre structural framework for a film to be built on.
I said it before, this is the epitome of a 2010s horror movie in the worst ways.
I'm not sure I'd agree with you on that. I think that a 2010s horror movie is something not what this movie is. I think what we're talking about here, what you're talking about, is the dying gasps of the 2000s.
Yes, right. This is late 2000s, like 2009, Prom Night, Platinum Dunes.
It has everything. It has choppy editing. It has a high school setting that makes no twisted sense. It has thin-ass characters. Very shoddy third act. It has this blue tint to it that doesn't need to be there. It is everything. It's like,
that's the thing.
I just expect better.
Well, Wes Craven, look, I'm going to say something that's probably sacrilegious to a lot of horror fans, but Wes Craven is not as good a director as some people like to make him out to be. He's a very fine director who made some fantastic movies, but he made as many misses as he did hits. And he doesn't have the kind of... Even when, say, John Carpenter made a miss, there's still a degree of creativity in there that he never made something generic, you know?
No, whereas when John Carpenter flames out, he flames out spectacularly.
Yeah. Whereas Wes Craven did on multiple locations.
Sometimes within the same movie as good stuff. I mean, the comedic cops in Last House on the Left.
And Wes Craven's career is really buttressed by Scream and by Nightmare on Elm Street. And he's got a couple of others in there that people have fond memories of. The People Under the Stairs, for instance. But at The Hills Have Eyes, even though that's more of a premise than a movie. The Last House on the Left. But other than that, his career was full of misses. Whereas you have someone like Carpenter, who I think, I don't know about you, but Wes Craven and John Carpenter always seem to be mentioned in the same breath as each other because of the time that they were operating in, because they are responsible
contemporaries.
For... they're contemporaries, but they're also responsible for the two most definition... Two of the three defining slasher franchises, you know?
Yeah.
But John Carpenter, he had Halloween, but he also had Escape from New York. He also had The Thing. He also had They Live and Prince of Darkness.
In the Mouth of Madness.
Big Trouble in Little China. In the Mouth of Madness. Christine.
Ghost of Mars.
Yes, true. They all flame out towards the end. But I'm just saying that Carpenter's hits hit more frequently than Craven's. Yeah. And what I see here in this movie, My Soul to Take, is Craven trying to, after a string of misses, string of movies that didn't do well, and at a point in his career where he doesn't have the kind of creative control that he wants anymore, Cursed being a prime example of that, he's trying to remix the greatest hits. This is a movie that takes the supernatural slasher villain of Nightmare on Elm Street, combines it with the sort of dream premonitions of Shocker, adds the sort of modern slasher mystery of Scream, and then even like chucks in the collecting souls thing from that one sequel to Nightmare on Elm Street where Freddy's got them all on pizzas. It really is a hodgepodge of his various influences. And there's a version of that that could be a greatest hits. It could be a victory lap. But this movie, instead of being
Williamson did the script.
Instead of being a cover version of his favorite themes that says something about his career and about his the stories that he told, it is instead a Frankenstein's monster of stitched together ideas that never coheres.
It's like if you got a really, really good cut of beef and you steamed it.
Mm.
It becomes all gray and tough and...
I don't know about that. I think this movie's too crazy for that. It's like if you've got a really good cut of beef and, like,
slathered it in chocolate.
Exactly.
It tastes bad, but it's funny.
Yeah.
It's like, I've made a birthday cake out of cow.
And I think we can all count our blessings that Scream 4 was to follow the next year, and that this movie was not the final movie that he ever directed. It's the final movie that he wrote and directed. But the final movie he ever made was Scream 4, which has done nothing but age well with its sort of social media, internet famous kind of commentary.
Like, it's not
it's
my
almost
favorite.
Like Kevin Williamson knows what he's doing.
Yeah, like, it's not my favorite Scream movie.
No.
No. That would still have to be 1, 2, and 6. That's my top 3.
I have to think about it. I think this movie would probably be my fourth. Scream 4 would probably be my fourth, I mean. Because I agree with you. 1, 2, and then it would be one of the new ones above Scream 4. But I still can't make up my mind which. I think I need to watch them both back-to-back again.
I just love the ballsiness
New York. I bet it would be a great back-to-back experience. Mm.
But the different thing is, okay, Wes Craven was not... He was a writer, and he did write some of his films. But... towards the end of his career, he wasn't writing them anymore, and so it had been a big break. So, all right, we'll give him that. But there's a lack of competency in the filming as well. It's just the basic shot, reverse shot. Like, there's a manic.
It feels It feels like it's missing something.
Yeah, it's sort of ADD. It's all over the place. The connective tissue isn't there. It's going over here and over here. It's like a dog on red. Hyped up on red cordial.
Why did the blind kid end up in Bug's house? Like,
they try to explain it.
They try to explain
it.
Good
explanation.
Poorly.
Why is the kid blind anyway? Like, I don't say that in the sense of, like, you know, if you've got a reason for him to be blind, sure, make him blind. If you've got a big set piece designed around the fact that he can't see the killer and he's got to survive, great, go for it. But they never, ever do anything at all. And in fact, it just creates problems because we're supposed to buy that this blind kid climbed up the side of a house through the window?
Mm.
Even and, though, like...
to be fair, Whitaker crushes it.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, he's got really good blind acting, which is... No, seriously,
yeah, I know,
like,
what you mean. It's just a strange turn of phrase.
It is incredibly difficult to accomplish because when you're acting... That.
Your first instinct is to look at the person
who's
talking.
Yeah, the instinct is to look at the source of noise. That is how people who are, like, people who can still see, that's what they do. You have to learn a whole different way of interacting with the world. And for an actor who still has sight, that can be...
And I mean, to be fair, though, he's Forrest Whitaker's son.
Is he really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that his name is Denzel Whitaker.
Mm.
He's named after Denzel
friend.
Washington.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, I think that...
And he's really good.
One thing I will say, I'm not sure I'd go really good, but I will give credit to all of the young performers here with what they do with the material that they're given. Because they're not given an easy job with this dialogue or this story. But
Fuck, he tries.
He tries. And he's actually quite effective when asked to do these sort of multiple personality things. When actually asked to speak in a voice other than Bugs.
Yeah,
and
when he stands up and when he sort of has that moment where he snaps into the performance of the California Condor thing. Mm. Like, his presence there is fucking fascinating.
Because it's Jay in that moment.
Yeah.
Mm. I love the little touch where the teacher starts to say something, and then he switches back to Bug and says, "It's all just theatricality, sir." Back into the big booming voice. Like, Thoreau is, like, doing a really good job here. He's hamstrung with a bad script and not enough direction.
And it's such a weird... It's a weird casting for him because he's playing this sort of, like, bullied nerd when Thoreau's entire career after this has just been really tough people on shows like SEAL Team and Fire Country.
And Bates Motel.
He was Freddie Highmore's brother.
Excellent performance from him in Bates Motel.
Oh, yeah, he's like, great in Bates Motel.
He, Highmore, and...
Farmiga.
Fucking crush it every episode. Mm.
He and Thoreau and Emily Mead, who plays Fang, his sister, they are the only of the young performers that make it out of this movie. The rest of them have sort of been lost to the general wash of, you know, failed young acting careers. But
and one of them didn't get much of a chance.
Yes, the actor who played Brandon, Nick Lashaway, died in a car accident when he was 28.
Yeah.
But Emily Mead, I mean, I'm not going to, like, she hasn't exactly had spectacular luck, but she's done some things. She was in The Deuce, that HBO show, for 3 seasons, and she's made a couple of appearances elsewhere, but her career is not on the life support that everyone else's is.
Talking about Fang, I don't mind the concept. She witnessed some horrific shit and is obviously going to be affected by that.
Yeah, but she's like...
But the high school shit is so insipid.
Yeah, but she has wandered out of a sequel to Brick. Like, the whole little, like, high school kingpin thing, it's from a completely different movie. And this, like, she's just going around getting Brandon to punch people at, like, different number degrees of severity for no apparent reason. Like, it's such a... I will say, I thought they pulled off the reveal that she is his sister.
Yes.
That
was well done.
That was well done. It is a surprise. Even though there's really no point to keep it a secret, there's no, like, dramatic point to it.
It's sort of just kept in the background of, they talk about a prior knowledge and relationship with Bug, but they keep it vague enough that it's, you know, could have just been going to school together for a long time.
I remembered... from seeing it the first time.
Well, yeah, I remembered as well, but, you know.
You know, it's interesting how they seed that. That plays itself pretty honestly.
It is.
And honestly, the reveal that Alex has the Ripper's soul in him, that's played pretty honestly too. I mean, it plays fair. It doesn't pull...
I don't know. I don't really buy that Alex is this sort of giant looming guy chasing him on the bridge at the beginning, or, like, that stuntman is a lot bigger than that actor.
But, like, when we look at, like, the stature of the killers in other Mars, you also have to talk about Scream. Especially Scream 6.
But Scream is more... I don't think you need to talk about Scream 6 because that wasn't Craven. But Scream, the ghost faces are always a little more lithe and a little, like, smaller in frame. They can...
It's about ambushing.
Yeah. They're not brutes. They're not, you know...
They're clumsy.
Tanks. Yeah, exactly. They can conceivably, once they're unmasked, you're like, all right, yes.
All but one are clumsy.
It's just a person.
In 6, not clumsy, not as clumsy as before.
What I don't get with the... Okay, so the mystery is almost belligerently silly. Like, it's so absurd, and it's hard to follow in how ridiculous it is, because it's throwing all of these details out to you that you're kind of like, okay, I'm... Maybe this will make sense later, but it never does. It, like, that Bug doesn't know that he was institutionalized. He doesn't remember that. He doesn't remember, like, this whole thing of, you know, the relationship that he and his sister had is just inexplicable. He doesn't understand that, his mother or his aunt is pretending to be his mother, and his sister's just never let that drop before. And he's never had any questions about his father, ever. And it's such a weird... artificial mystery, because it,
like,
actually...
If he weren't such a neurotic kid, I'd kind of buy it.
He's not even neurotic, he's an alien. I mean, they all are alien characters. They speak and behave like absolute... Like, it's just not what a person sounds like.
I can tell you the specific line that continued to piss me off. There's a revolution. God, it's insipid.
What about if things get too hot, just turn on the prayer conditioning?
I like that. Was funny. That does sound like something a churchy person would say.
But she's not even like a churchy person in the traditional sense. She is the kid from The Shining.
Like she knows shit.
She knows shit, but she doesn't communicate any of it. She just talks in riddles.
She should have been kept alive longer so that there could have been, you know, a discussion between her and Bug while things were going fucking mental.
Or bring her back as a force ghost in the mirror or whatever these visions are.
Like, she does appear, but have her talk at least.
Exactly. Have them appear more often.
That's the thing, is that this movie...
Like, black phone that shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's this hodgepodge of ideas, and there are so many ideas that they never follow through on any of them.
And a lot of ideas that have been done better since. Mm.
And that's,
and before.
I get what they were trying to do with the victims. Like, if they had pulled it off, we'd be talking about what a successful choice it was, because it doesn't follow the usual victim idea in a slasher movie. I mean, it leaves things unresolved. It takes the you know, what's her name? Penelope, the girl with the visions, who would in any other movie be the final girl, probably, and kills her off very quickly. It takes the love interest and kills her off without ever resolving that storyline.
It kills Penelope, the love interest, and Brandon in quick succession.
Yeah. It kills off Jay at the start when he is the Jamie Kennedy.
He seems the most well-adjusted, too.
But he's the Jamie Kennedy. He's the guy, the guy who's going to tell us the rules. And he goes at the very beginning. And so I think that is the point. I think that's what Craven is trying, is he's kind of trying to upend the victim conventions in these kinds of movies. And that...
But when you do that, you upend.
Well, it would be fine. As I said, I think we would be praising this choice if it had been done with sense. And if it had not done... what it ends up doing, which is in pulling out the tablecloth, it shatters all of the plates and the cutlery all over the floor, and all of the things...
It stops being a magic trick and starts being a mistake.
Exactly. All of the things that those characters were supporting, the plot lines, the exposition, by killing them off so early and by having no way to resolve them, I mean, it's like he just decided to stop telling the story in the middle. This character is gone, so every part of the story they're connected to is gone. And it ends up feeling unfinished as a result.
Frank Grillo is here.
Yep. Frank Grillo is a phenomenon that has only really occurred in the last 10 years or so. Yeah. I mean, he comes onto the scene. I mean, he was not really a actor of note. He was a working actor at this point. He had been in plenty of
He does his dues. Like, dude keeps working.
Oh, yeah.
Got to respect
but
the
you,
grind.
You look at his filmography around here, and it's like 4 episodes of The Shield, 18 episodes of Prison Break, 1 episode of CSI Without a Trace, CSI New York, Law and Order Special Victims Unit. And he does this movie, and it's not until after that that he actually starts to get some spotlight roles, really sort of starting with his entrance into the Captain America subseries and then The Purge Anarchy, both in the same year. And after
Which
that,
was really good.
Yeah, and after that he becomes a very solid sort of action B-lister, really. Yeah,
he plays a tough guy really, really well.
And that's another thing. You've got this character here who could be a really compelling Loomis figure. I mean, they've killed off other Loomis in the first 5 minutes. But this is a guy who has experience with the original. And again,
and he disappears for a vast swath of the film.
I shouldn't call him Loomis because he's not. He's the dad from Nightmare on Elm Street. He's the sheriff with the secret in the past. In fact, it's the same secret, it will be implied, because I don't think it's ever really explicitly stated, but the secret is that he murdered the Ripper in the woods when he found him. Mm. The Ripper is dead. He knows he's dead because he killed him extrajudicially. Mm.
Was that in, like, those deleted scenes?
Yes, yes. You don't see it happening, but there's a line of dialogue.
Son of a bitch!
You don't see it happening, but there's a line of dialogue from Fang when she's explaining it all to Bug. And she says, everyone was just ready to drop it. The town didn't want to be defined by this. Frank Grillo was not really looking to go on this because he stepped outside the bounds of his policeman's duty. So, yes, the implication there is that he pulled the same thing that the dad in Nightmare on Elm Street pulled. He killed the villain.
Well, we should have seen that.
Exactly.
He did what the eventual sheriff failed to do in Halloween Kills.
Mm.
He didn't put Michael down when he had the chance.
It's so, and as I talk through it, I just see more and more of those parallels. I see more and more of that Nightmare on Elm Street scream and shocker in a blender, and that's what this movie is.
And with an emphasis,
on blend. I do think it is incredibly entertaining. I've said a lot of negative things because this is a film analysis podcast, but I do think in its absurdity, in its messiness, it is spectacularly off.
It's a learning experience for filmmakers, I think. It's entertaining because it's doing so many things wrong. And at the same time, you've got Max Thoreau doing a very interesting performance. I would go as far as to say a pretty good performance. But what he's being directed to do is so bizarre and strange that this kid is inscrutable. It feels like melodrama. And it's kind of not in a good way.
There's two design points that I think are incredibly successful. One, the California Condor. That kicked ass. And I do love the design of the Ripper. He looks cool.
He does.
It's got this weird, like, waterlogged hermit, Halloween
PS1
shit.
Hagrid.
Kind of a PS1 Hagrid,
yes.
Yeah.
Like, Hagrid as Jason Voorhees, yeah.
Yeah,
it's like...
You're not wrong about the PS1 Hagrid thing.
It's like, you know what he actually looks like? The Riverton Ripper looks like if Jason Momoa drowned in a lake and they dragged his body out 3 days later.
No, it is... I wouldn't even say that. I would say it is Jason Momoa if he was one of these supernatural slasher villains who drowned and 20 years later was killing kids at a camp. Like,
no, it's like... It's Jason Momoa from Wrong Turn.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
But it's a cool look. It is really a cool look. And I do appreciate the simplicity that it's just knife kills.
Mm.
It's just stabbing.
It's just like, that there's so
the
much digital blood.
The digital blood in the execution is not great, but, you know, Wes Craven made the simplicity work in Scream. Like, most of the kills there, just knives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just stabbing. It can work. It's all about execution, and the execution here is the issue. I think that's what we've really come down to. The execution.
They shouldn't have killed 3 of them in the span of 6 minutes.
No, I appreciate that they did that, because that's not something you would see.
Yeah. Well, that's a thing.
Outside of the final circuit.
I will give it that. It is surprising that it does it, sure. But, like, what I think we're thinking about here is if someone had just taken this script away from Wes Craven and done another draft, you know.
If Kevin Williamson did it.
Sure. I mean, he was busy, I think, creating and running Vampire Diaries at this point.
I mean, sure, yeah.
But the thing of it is that Wes Craven has kind of lost his storytelling touch, which is seen in some of his comments following the movie, because he talked about how he didn't really see a lot of the problems in it. Like, he's just like, oh, you win some, you lose some. I think it's a really, really fun movie, but people didn't connect with it. He doesn't really see the fundamental structural issues that everyone else does, which is, I think, kind of an unfortunate statement on where his career had gone by that point, because he still has Scream 4 left in him, thank God. But leading up to it, it really was a string of unsuccessful films. Red Eye had done fine, but he'd just come off of Cursed. He'd spent a long time sort of grappling with the Hollywood system in a way that had really beaten him down. So did you guys hear about the premiere thing they did for this movie?
Yeah.
Yes.
Holly told me.
Like,
what
that,
the hell?
So, for the listeners, at the premiere, they did this, like, staged event where someone, like, got stabbed, a random stabbing in front of the cast and crew. And yeah. I did it as, like, this viral promotional thing. But that, like, that goes right to everything we're talking about here, is this complete misjudging of tone.
It's every instinct.
Yeah. It's every instinct failing.
Yeah. Like, not only does it fail as a promotional idea because it is so frankly stupid.
And
it also just makes me think of Scream 2, which is a movie I'd rather be thinking about.
Well, again, and it's also nothing like here is original. Like, even the promotional stunt is from a previous movie.
And the promotional stunt isn't actually, like, doesn't really feel like it's promoting My Soul to Take. Because if you think about it, the snow job that you do with this is, it is these seven kids who have parts of this killer's soul, this killer's personalities. That's the in. But having just someone stabbed in a cinema doesn't add anything. It doesn't say anything about the themes, it doesn't promote the film.
You don't fake it that just some random guy stabbed another random guy. You fake it that the Riverton Ripper runs out and stabs one of the kids.
Well, that's...
stabs one of the cast members.
Well, no, you have it be that the Ripper comes out and stabs Wes Craven.
What you're missing is the fact that they wanted people to believe it was real.
Yeah, that's the issue.
Yeah, that's
like,
the
I'm
issue.
Saying, like, you make a fun behind-the-scenes video or something that is, like, it's staged as if it's a behind-the-scenes footage thing, but it's actually just a fun little gag.
Yeah, but what
that could be cool. That could be fun.
But what it's designed to do is instead be this real-life, quote-unquote, thing that can then go viral and be used to promote the movie. Mm. When in fact, what it really is just like an actually kind of disturbing, like, misunderstanding of, I don't know, it's kind of blending the real world with, like,
we're horror fans. We don't want to see real world violence.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm not successfully saying. You're exactly right that there's a misunderstanding of the point.
Yeah, with a home movie, we sit at a natural disconnect. You know, the screen does a hell of a lot of the work.
This isn't
for
Faces
us.
Of Death. It's a Wes Craven movie.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, this isn't a movie where you're going around talking to actual serial killers or actual war criminals and then getting them to reenact their crimes. It's like, no, this is a dumb 2010 fucking movie about some dude with personality disorder.
You're Wes Craven, not Werner Herzog.
Exactly. I think that's the issue. It's like, you're not Werner Herzog. Because Werner Herzog doing this, I can see it. I can see him getting stabbed by someone and still being able to promote his movie.
Wasn't he shot during an interview once?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was with a BB gun. Yeah, and he was just like, I've been shot.
He just kept going.
Like a badass.
You sort of see him go, oh, I think I've been shot.
Yeah, he shrugs it off.
Werner Herzog was once shot with an air rifle during an interview. And then when you type in Werner Herzog shot, one of the, like, question things that Google comes up with is, how many times has Werner Herzog been shot?
More than you think.
There was
honestly,
that story of
that's
Klaus Kinski.
That's a fair question.
There was all of those stories about Klaus Kinski, and who knows how much of that is apocryphal.
I mean, it's a fair question. Werner Herzog does go to a lot of dangerous places.
He rolls people up. Mm. Fuck, I love Werner Herzog. He's so interesting.
Interrupting the interview with a strange crack, Werner Herzog looks down to see that he'd been shot by a bullet shot from an air rifle, with the filmmaker approaching the incident with his typically calm demeanor, leaving the scene of the crime. Kermode and Herzog retreat to a safe studio where they break down the event, with Herzog lifting his shirt to show the considerable purple bruise before stating, it's not significant.
That's badass.
Yeah, Werner Herzog kicks ass. Always has, always will.
The journalist Mark Kermode later said, every time Herzog tells the story, he becomes more courageous, and we, the BBC, become more and more cowardly. Ah, yes, they were ducking and running away.
That's awesome. I do love that. And also his description of disturbed penguins walking into the center of the continent.
All right,
he will not turn back to his group. He will walk and walk, this possibly deranged penguin.
I do love how he describes jungle life as perpetual agony, and the birds are less screaming, less singing,
more
screaming.
The birds are not singing, they are screaming.
All right, if we're doing Werner Herzog impressions, then it must mean that we've reached the end of this conversation.
I would like to say that I appreciate the locations they filmed that.
Yeah.
That bridge. damn, that's a spooky ass bridge. Like, what the hell? That place is probably that bridge is probably legitimately haunted.
This is a movie that had such potential and could have been really interesting, but it is interesting in its failure. And that's sort of an important thing for a film analysis. Not only seeing something that is excellent, like Social Network, which we deconstruct all of its successes, but something like My Soul to Take, where we can deconstruct its failures.
All right, so now why don't we move on to our segment of where we identify the character in this movie most likely to still have the blue check mark next to their name on Elon Musk's Twitter?
Brandon.
Brandon, yes. There's really no other option. It's Brandon.
It seems fairly simple this time around.
Yep. So now why don't we each go around and say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favorite scene or sequence is, and of course, who we would recast with this podcast's patron saint, character actor, John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
I will start us off, and I will say that my MVP here for this movie is Max Thoreau. I think that he is the only one who makes it out totally unscathed, who you can't really critique for the effort. He's not brilliant.
He's doing what's asked of him, and he's doing it well.
Exactly. He's not brilliant, but he's doing what's asked of him competently and with commitment. And the best acting performances in this movie are from him. He gets the best acting moments, the best acting scenes. When he's asked to take on other personalities than the personality of Bug, he does so well. It's just that everything he's being asked to do is in service of a flawed objective. But what he is doing is not the problem. So I'm going to give it to him. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, it's got to be that first 5 minutes. I mean, that if I ever watch anything from this movie again, it will be that first 5 minutes. I've got no interest in the rest of it. But that really is insane. It's like seeing an entire episode of Criminal Minds in like 5 minutes. It's nuts, and it just keeps going. It has no real clue that it's nuts. The way that he keeps coming back from the dead and killing people, or like the way that it just keeps escalating, escalating and escalating and escalating. The way that fake Dr. Loomis is on the scene, and the way that all of that dialogue between, you know, can't you just show some humanity to the police officer? I mean, it's absurd in the most batshit ADHD kind of way possible, and it really
is.
The
fact that he pulls a fucking Hannibal Lecter, gets up and crashes the ambulance.
Yeah, it's nuts, and it's the only, like, if you watch anything from this movie, just watch that on YouTube. It's great fun, and so I got to go with that. In terms of who I would recast with this podcast, patron saint, character actor John Lithgow, it's got to be pretend Dr. Loomis. You get him in there quick, you get him out quick. He's in the best, in quotes, the best sequence of the movie, I think he would fit that role and bring some gravitas to it. But I also think that he would have the sort of self-awareness to understand the camp and the silliness of what he's doing. So I would put him there.
So for me, I would have to give my MVP to Max Thoreau. He is doing what is asked of him. He is doing it very well, even though he's working with subpar material. He's dedicated, and he's not phoning anything in, which, honestly, is more than he needed to do. And it's that kind of dedication that I respect. My favorite scene or sequence has to be the California Condor thing. I really like the practical costume that they made. I think that was incredibly well done. How did he do it in a night? I don't know. And just Thoreau's performance during that sequence. The tonal variations that he's able to reach is very, very fascinating. And it gives us the movie's one piece of symbology. And it's a pretty fun, interesting symbol, even though they, you know, beat that bony horse to death with it. Who I would replace with John Lithgow? My instinct is to choose the psychiatrist at the beginning, but I'd like to see him in the Frank Grillo role.
The idea of John Lithgow extrajudiciously murdering someone in the woods?
No. It's more, it means I get to see him and less of, it means I get to see him in more of the movie. I mean, it's not great for his career. It wouldn't affect it, to be frank, but it also means I get Lithgow in there from time to time to make me feel better. Sometimes it's not a choice that makes perfect sense, it's more of an act of self-preservation. Although I do agree with Lawson's point, you do make a very compelling argument.
I'll
bring Grillo in the role, but I just need Lithgow there as sort of a life raft.
I'll give it to Max Thoreau, because, I mean, he does such a good job at what he's given. The tonal variations when he's putting on the other people's voices, the way he changes his body language, his face, he does such a good job at those switches. And just when he's playing Bug, there's a sense of frailty to the guy that a stiff wind could blow him over. And he seems to be on the spectrum too, which I think is interesting. But not, it's not to the point of mocking. He's very clearly a very sympathetic guy with a lot sort of going on. I think my favorite scene or sequence is... See, I really love the part where he and Alex are mirroring each other, because I feel like that's such a fun exercise.
But it's also really tough to pull off.
Really tough to pull off. But I think I give it to the California Condor thing, because I feel like it's the one moment where the movie's actually successful, where it pulls off Bug taking on this other personality after one of them has passed on. That seems to have been the idea that was lost in the shuffle. I feel like Craven was too close to this, that if he was able to pull back and give another person a shot at the script, that it would have been more successful. For who I would get John Lithgow as, if it's modern day Lithgow, the Loomis character. I don't even know. Who knows what that doctor's name was?
Harris Yulin.
Whatever. It doesn't
matter.
He was
really on the X-Files.
I mean, the character's name.
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
Doesn't matter. No one cares.
That guy was in Ghostbusters 2 as well, as the judge.
Oh, shit, really? He was.
Oh, that's cool. But anyway, that's a better horror movie than this. It's more scary. But yeah, I'd give him that Loomis role, because it's a vibe we haven't actually seen from Lithgow before. It's a vibe I think he could pull off, that sort of paranoid... Malcolm McDowell sort of careening off of the steep edge of sanity into the inky blackness below kind of thing. I think he could do a good job at that, but he's also not in the movie for very long, so it can be a thing of, oh shit, John Lithgow's here. Oh shit, he's dead. Huh. Okay. Yeah, it's easy work.
Yeah, so now we're going to put it to a vote, whether or not we are a pro My Soul to Take podcast or not.
No.
I actually couldn't get through that, sorry. Lawson, why don't you cast your vote first?
I am voting for only, I think, the second time, or maybe the third time, Anti. This is a movie that is not... It should not have been made. Not in this way. It fails fundamentally at everything that it attempts. It does not succeed. That's the thing. I mean, if we're going to come up with a... And we have talked in the past about what makes an Anti vote. Well, it's a movie that is so fundamentally flawed that it just is not right. It's not correct. Mm-hmm. It's just not doing anything proper or appropriate in terms of succeeding in its stated objectives and goals. The only movie that we have officially been anti is The Happening. And I think I can draw a lot of parallels between that movie and this.
Yeah.
But this movie is even more split in its perspectives. It's even more uncontrolled in the ways that it's going off the rails. And while The Happening still has a sort of cohesive feel, it's nuts, but it has a full...
It's got something it's trying to say.
Yeah, it has a full and complete perspective to it, whereas this is all over the place. It's jeering all about the place. It's got all sorts of dropped subplots and cut things and stuff that doesn't make any sense. And I just can't think of any reason why we shouldn't be anti this movie. Mm. So it's an anti vote from me.
And it's going to be an anti from me. I don't like doing that. I just don't. But if we look at the criteria of what makes an anti, Lawson's exactly right. This isn't one of those situations where it needed a little more time in the kiln. This isn't another one of those situations where if they shuffled a couple of things around, it could have worked. They needed to go back to the start. They needed to go back to the beginning and just do a reset. And the concept is so good. The concept is really, really solid, but that's why the execution is so flawed. The execution is so flawed that it compromises everything. Everything. And it strands the actors. It's just not good. It's not good.
Well, that's around the point. It's bad.
Bad.
That is the word. It's bad. It's a bad movie.
I had fun, but less than I should have.
Yeah. And it's an anti for me. Look, this is a movie that fails at what it sets out to do. It's not scary. It's barely entertaining. It's not even entertaining for the right reasons. The story is a mess. The mystery is a mess. The third act, it was refilmed and replotted, but is still tragic. It fails at being a movie. If you trust what Wes Craven said, that this was his final edit of the movie, then why does it feel like it was butchered by a studio? Like, that's the question. Like, it feels like a butcher job. This entire idea needed to be put back to factory settings and started again. It has some good moments, but it's not a good movie. It's bad. It's an actively bad film.
So there you have it. We are not a pro My Seltzer Take podcast. We are, in fact, a rare anti. Mm-hmm. We are an anti My Seltzer Take podcast.
Get out of here! Can't you see we don't want you anymore? Why can't you go back where you came from? Leave us alone!
I don't like voting anti, but it means we get to use this clip again.
Yeah.
Look, it just needed...
That's always the silver lining.
It's never great to film a draft.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
And like the anti thing, you know, this is our prestige Blu-ray line, our imaginary prestige Blu-ray line, and this is one where someone came in and said, guys, I got a pitch for you.
They're going out the window. Yes.
Where they're being grabbed by lapel and dragged out by security. I mean, who let this lunatic in here? Yeah.
They're not even going to get the dignity of being able to say, it's fine, I'm leaving. No, they are forcefully picking you up like a baby and dropping you on your ass outside the building.
They're going to pitch My Soul to Take, and then they're going to also pitch us putting glue on our feet and walking on the roof. It's that kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's...
So, if you would to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find Lawson at Exit Through the Candy Counter if I join myself on the bright side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about My Soul to Take? To turn things into a little bit more of a positive space, what is your favorite Wes Craven project?
Scream 1.
I also have a lot of love for Wes Craven's New Nightmare. I love that movie.
My favorite Nightmare on Elm Street is the third one.
Yeah, but that's not Craven.
He co-wrote it, I think.
But he produced a lot of them, didn't he?
It's my favorite of them because of the puppet scene.
That was the one he came back. He didn't direct it, but he co-wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so you can also like, rate, comment, and subscribe on your podcast app of choice. Just keep in mind that on certain podcast apps, you're commenting on the show on the whole, and on others, you're commenting on specific episodes. But if you are commenting on the whole, just let us know which episodes you're referring to. It means we can cater the experience a little bit better and understand what you're talking about. But please do like, comment, and subscribe. In the Robot Run future, spices have become incredibly important. Not spices you would understand it from Dune, because that's a hallucinogenic drug, but spices in the modern world are very rare and very, very well sought after. Only the richest among us can eat spicy food now.
Oh, so you just mean spice in the sense of, like, normal spicy
food.
Yeah,
I don't think people would have jumped to... I don't think people would have sort of, like...
Jumped to Dune over the standard dictionary definition of spice.
I don't think they would have been, like, Baron Harkonnen rising out of his fucking tar pit being like, it's my spice.
Well, speaking of Baron Harkonnen, connections have been drawn between his depiction in the Denis Villeneuve Dune to the current reign of Colonel Sanders. The search for spice.
Alright.
What?
11 Secret Herbs and Spices.
We got it, Harley.
Is that a robot him, or is he back from the dead?
robot him, he's actually. Already,
Jean, pay attention. We've heard so many times about the rampage of the fast food takeaway mascots.
No, but he was being so... I don't know. That
no,
one
no,
didn't...
no. He's still frozen.
These are the mad ramblings of a forgotten prophet.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on. Okay.
What are we watching next week?
Please have something better.
I really, really like the movie we're going to talk about next week. It's a different kind of movie than we've done maybe ever.
You didn't say better. Say it's
better, it's a much better movie. It's a much better movie. It's a different kind of movie than we've done maybe ever. It's certainly a movie of a tone and type that we haven't done in quite a while. And it will be, I think, our second Australian film behind Wolf Creek 2. It is Red Hill, the neo-Western starring Ryan Kwanten. If you would like to find it and watch along at home, you can find it to rent or purchase on the YouTube, Fetch, Apple, and Amazon stores.
I'm glad to watch another Australian film. We really don't do that enough.
I take it you guys haven't seen this movie.
No, yeah. No, but I'd be interested. And we also don't do a lot of Westerns.
Yeah. I vaguely know the title.
Particularly neo-Westerns. So that'll be pretty interesting. I'm looking forward to that. So, what's its name again? Red Hill?
Red Hill, yes.
Yep, so join us next week for when we discuss Red Hill. Until then, I have been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been and will continue to be Jean Lewis. It's all about soul. It's all about joy that comes out of sorrow. It's all about